everyone. I'm Ashley McManus, Senior Director of Global Marketing at SmartEye. Welcome to the Human-Centric AI Podcast, where each episode we feature thought leaders doing cutting-edge work in the AI space. A little bit about us. SmartEye is the global leader in human insight AI, technology that understands, supports, and predicts human behavior in complex environments, bridging the gap between humans and machines for a safe and sustainable future. Today's episode features Dr. Michael Seiler, an expert in marketing and consumer behavior at the Raymond A. Mason School of Business at the College of William & Mary. Dr. Seiler is an internationally recognized behavioral real estate researcher whose studies have been cited in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, LA Times, and Washington Post. He has published over 185 research studies, has written several books, and is currently the number one ranked real estate researcher, consulting in the areas of behavioral and experimental real estate and finance. Dr. Seiler's research focuses on the intersection of technology, marketing, and consumer behavior, and he has a particular interest in how effective computing can be used to understand people's responses to financial products. In this episode, Mike shares his thoughts into how he used Affectiva's Emotion AI technology to assess people's attitudes towards financial products by showing them the content and measuring their emotional responses to it. Let's listen in to learn more. Okay. Hi, everyone. And thank you so much for joining us today. With me, I have Michael Seiler. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. So to start, tell us briefly about your background. How has your career path taken you to what you are working on today?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I loved to write. I would write all these stories. They were kind of like 007 spy stories and things like that. And so I always loved the writing, which turned out to be something that would really benefit you as a professor. There's a lot more of that than you might think. And I was always really good at math. And so when I went to college, I thought, okay, just major in math. And then when I did that, I thought, okay, I've taken all the math courses. Now what? I didn't feel fulfilled. And so my older brother said, you know, we use a lot of math in finance. He was in business school. I was in engineering. And I said, all right, well, let me try it out. I took a class, loved it, took all the econ stats courses. And I thought, okay, this is my thing. This is what I can do. I went to get a PhD eventually, and I was in a finance program, but I met a real estate person there. And he became a mentor to me and a good friend. And he said, you know, Mike, finance is great. And you're trained in it, and that's going to help you. But, you know, most of the finance topics, they've kind of all been turned over. They've been studied. In real estate, we break all of those convenient assumptions. So we don't have, for example, these complex markets with many buyers and sellers. Transactions costs aren't low. You know, so the price discovery process is very slow. And you know, so come answer some of our questions and don't try to be the 10th person who's answered the same question over at finance. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I started in real estate. I started looking at some of the things there, and I realized, wow, people do not make these fully rational decisions, or it might be more accurate to say that, you know, there's a behavioral component to it. So if I'm going to really understand how people make real estate decisions, I better learn much more about psychology, right? And so I really threw myself into that. There was a steep learning curve, like any time you enter a new field. So that's really come together. And then the technological component came in, you know, with that as kind of a third leg to that stool, and I've been off and running ever since. I absolutely love what I do and so passionate about it.
Nice. You hit a lot of different things. We got psychology, engineering, finance, real estate, all these awesome stuff. So it's very, very cool.
If you want to get to the bottom of these things, you have to go where the research takes you.
Awesome. So Affectiva's co-founder and former CEO, Dr. Renal Kalyubi, actually connected us, and she believes that, you know, this is a really innovative use of our technology to understand people's responses to financial products by showing them content and then assessing their attitudes towards it. So let's start there. Can you take us through the thought process of what you wanted to do and why and how you went about using Affectiva to achieve it?
Yeah. So first of all, Ron is great. She's fantastic. And thank you so much to her and Affectiva for helping out with this. So I do a lot of policy papers, right? And so the CARES Act rolls out and they put together this massive plan in a week. And I'm thinking, okay, wait, we should have done this. We could have done that. And so I really care about these policy issues because it's a very applied part of what I do. You know, sometimes I'll write a mathematically theoretical paper and I wonder who will ever read it, maybe four people on the planet. And so you question, you know, the validity of that, like the importance of it. But policy papers are really great because they involve real people. They affect people's lives. And the interesting thing about a policy is I always tell people, whether I'm consulting with the government or a private firm or really just doing my research, I always say, wouldn't it be nice if we could kind of pretest a policy before rolling it out where real people might lose money or get hurt or lose their house or, you know what, depends on the topic. Now, that's not always possible. In the CARES Act, they needed to do it immediately. There was no time for that. I still tested some policy things after the fact and said, here's what you should have done. But as it relates to policy and mortgages, I mean, pretty much everyone around the country is thinking about this. You may already own a home. You almost certainly have a mortgage if you do, or maybe you're just thinking about buying a home. But these are thoughts that are on everyone's mind. And the old-fashioned way of trying to learn people's opinion of these different potential policies that come out is, of course, you can just ask people, right? You can go, hey, Ashley, how do you feel about this? And if it is a very simple question, and if it's a non-controversial question, like I say, hey, do you like apple pie or blueberry pie? You're just going to tell me which one you really like, and I should believe you, right? That's an easy choice, and why would you lie to me about that? But the difficult thing is if it's a very complex question, and I'll get into what we looked at in the affectiva study in a minute, but what if I just said, hey, what is it that you like about your house? You might really try to tell me the answer, and you're like, well, I don't know. I get a good feel. I'm like, okay, well, that's not a thing. Well, tell me more. Oh, I don't know. I just like it here. Okay, you're not helping me at all. So people may intend to tell you exactly what they are feeling, and they might just not be able to. They might not do a good job. Here's another example. Let's say that you feel exactly, or you know exactly what you feel, but you're afraid that if you tell me, I might judge you, right? So this is a very, very common thing for surveyors. If they ask people questions, they know that the person who is answering is in a way trying to please or at least not be judged by the person who's asking the question. And so that alone can manipulate their answer. We don't want that. We just want a pure understanding of people's inner thoughts. So what I've described so far is called a stated preference. I ask you a question and you state what you believe. And I just pointed out two reasons why that might not be great. So what I'd rather do, I'd like to reveal your preference. So I'm going to ask you something, but instead of it being direct, I'm going to try to infer in some way how you really feel about that situation. Affectiva software can do just that. And so when I heard about it, I thought, oh, this is something I've got to get my hands on this. And so I reached out to Affectiva. They were extremely gracious. I mean, I have to tell you, as a researcher, we are often at the mercy of companies to provide data, to provide, you know, any kind of software, technology. And we don't have the world's biggest research budgets, and we're really not paying customers for the most part. So if we are, it's kind of a one-time purchase, right? And so Affectiva was just absolutely fantastic. They allowed us to use their software, even stack the results once we got it, and we were off and running there.
Very cool. Yeah, and recently I know a paper that you wrote featuring this use of the Affectiva technology won Best Paper of the Year award, published in the Journal of Real Estate Research, which I think is one of the top three real estate journals at American Real Estate Society, or AREs. And there was an annual 2023 meeting. Can you please summarize in layman's terms, it's a very technical paper, what the findings of the paper were or any kind of data trends that you saw?
Sure. Yeah. Let me tell you how this idea worked. And so I've been doing a lot of other experiments on something called strategic mortgage default. So let me just define a couple of terms. An economic default is what you're probably thinking of. That's I can't afford to pay my mortgage and therefore I simply can't. So it's not a choice. It's just an economic constraint. Now, there are some other people who don't pay the mortgage, but those folks can afford to. They just decide for some reason they're not going to. And I could talk for 10 hours on why that might be. We'll set up a whole season of podcasts on why that might not be. But trust me, there are some reasons why, and many of them are psychological and behavioral. So what I wanted to do is I said, okay, I want to understand more about this strategic mortgage default. It's an area that I've developed a lot of papers in and put a lot of thought into because it matters so much for the industry. When people default, it can have a spillover effect on your neighbors. It can cause mortgage rates to go up. So it is costly for everyone. It's not that, oh, I didn't do it, so it doesn't affect me. No, it affects everyone. So everyone really has a hand in the pot. They have a dog in the fight, so to speak.
Yeah.
I also have looked at lenders who have put people into loans that they shouldn't be in. So if we think back to the great financial crisis of 2008, it was really arguments on both sides. Okay, so borrowers maybe shouldn't have taken out that loan. Okay, but maybe you shouldn't have loaned them money if they weren't qualified to, you know, so it's kind of a two-way street. And then an additional layer most people don't think about that I've got a number of papers in is when it goes to collection, collection agencies have a number of techniques that they can use in order to get that money back for the bank, or if the bank has sold the loan to someone else, for that third party. And so I've done just a tremendous amount of work on that. So I wanted to put all this together. I thought, who knows, maybe I only get one bite of the Affectiva apple, throw everything in there and really get your money's worth out of it, right? So I put together this script. It was read by a professional, I say a professional actor. He does work at William & Mary, but he's the dean of our MBA program. Great guy, a history of doing, you know, news and radio shows and stuff. He's got the perfect voice and a really good look. So I had him read off this script. First part of the script was about a young couple who defaulted on their mortgage. Then it goes into the story about how the lender should not have put them in that mortgage in the first place. And then finally, now that it is in collections, that this collection agency is using these behavioral techniques to trick the borrower into repaying back at a higher rate using something called the decoy effect, which I've studied, you know, many times over. So it's really a long, I'd say long, about 2 minute story, but it hits you on ups and downs. I mean, first you're against the borrowers because why did they do that? Why did they default? And then you might be against the lenders. Well, why did they loan them the money in the first place? Yeah. And then you could be against the debt collector, which is pretty easy to get on board with. Why did they use this behavioral or psychological technique to get the money out of these people at a higher APR or higher rate of return or interest rate? And so what we do is we tell that story to people, and then they answer a series of questions. That's kind of the old-fashioned way. Hey, how did you view the borrower? How did you view the lender? How did you view the debt collector? And all that stuff is great. Problem is, it doesn't take place in real time. In real time, they watch the video, and then after that, they answer these questions.
Right.
And what the literature knows very well is that when you are asked something after the fact, your memory is a little bit off, or you have time to put on top of that a social screen, and you might be thinking, well, how should I feel about this? No, I didn't ask how you should feel about it. I want to know how you actually feel about it. But we just can't help ourselves, because if you are in society, then these things matter to you. And if you fit well into society, then you do these things on a subconscious level. So again, you can't even decouple these things if you wanted to. And you're probably not even aware that you do them, right? Most people aren't. So Affectiva software allowed us in real time, as these folks are watching this video on their computer at their house, we have a portal through which we are recording them. So every micro expression that they make, and there are some 7 or 8 core emotional reactions that people can have. And these reactions can be what we call micro expressions. So if I made you really mad right now, Ashley, you might carry on for 20 seconds and I'll be like, yeah, everyone can see she's quite upset with me. But what if I said something controversial and you didn't like it, but you're trying to remain, you know, just this is a work thing you're doing. You're trying to remain, you know, objective and professional and not be part of the story, but you just can't help yourself. You're a human being. You have emotions. And so what this Affectiva software can do is it can identify or pick up on these micro expressions, just a natural reaction that was so immediate that you did not have time to suppress it. So we kind of caught a glimpse that you were getting angry, but then you're like, oh, no, shut that down, be objective. But the computer sees it. And so when these recordings are being done, we have this, you know, recording that gets sent back to Affectiva. We have 600 people in one treatment, 600 people in another. Affectiva was just amazing in stacking all of that data together and then giving it to us in a format that we could analyze. And what we were basically trying to figure out is, do people object to these three different parties? And if so, what is their objection exactly? We know we could ask them, and we did ask them, but what is their true objection? How do they really feel about these things? And going back to the big picture, why does it matter? Because if you are a GSE, part of the government, if you are trying to set forth a policy that is going to be well accepted by society, then don't you care about how people in society view it?
Yeah.
So our laws are based on the general, you know, morality, I guess, or views of society that we have. And so they reflect that. Hopefully our housing policy should reflect what we value as a community, right? And so policy questions should really incorporate how everyone feels and how everyone views the world. And it can be different from one country to another, right? Everyone has different values. They're not right or wrong, but the way we live should reflect those values.
Fascinating. It's so interesting to hear this kind of application that, because we use something similar in the ad testing industry, like unfiltered, kind of unbiased responses to what people are seeing. And so it's interesting to see the parallels. So Rana also believed that this has the potential to change, you know, how research is done in academia too. So not just in the advertising world. And what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I hope she's right, because if she's wrong, then I'm going down the wrong path, because this is exactly what I do. And I think that when you come across a company who has cutting edge technology, it absolutely should be put to use in a way to answer questions that simply cannot be answered through historical means. And this is a great example of that, right? I mean, if somebody produced the technology and it doesn't allow you to do anything different or anything better, then I don't care about that. I mean, yeah, I think it's great for what that company wants to do. But as far as the research is concerned, I am constantly scouring the universe for, is there something out there that can allow us to look deeper or to look at a set of questions that have simply been ignored because there's no data on it, or we can't measure people's emotions in this case. But now we can. And so, wow, that opens a ton of doors. I can tell you that if I had a team of people and you just said, hey, go nuts and answer questions for the next 10 years, I would say, wow, can I get more people? Because there are so many questions out there that this opens the door to. It's like a beautiful Pandora's box, like in a good way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Now, taking a step back and looking at kind of the technical aspects of this, can you share some of the mechanics, maybe some of the challenges around how you went about setting this up?
Sure. So I am a behavioral real estate researcher. I run experiments, but I'm not a computer scientist. And so one of the things that I get faced with is when I find a new technology, and then it's like, oh, well, now you have to figure out how you're going to use that. Yeah. And it's really great because, these companies understand that if they're offering something new, then people aren't going to know how to use it. And so they work with us on that. So I'll just give you briefly how that would work. So Affectiva does what they do, and they've got it all handled, and it's easy as pie for them. But for a person like me who hadn't used it before, I said, well, I don't want to just have it on my computer and have one person come in and sit at the computer and watch our video, because, wow, that's going to take forever. And I can do the same paper, but it's going to take me 2 years instead of 2 days. Yeah. So I'm always thinking about how can I collect this data in a very succinct and efficient fashion, and then run my analysis to go on to my next study. Because as you can tell from my voice and my speech pattern, I'm very passionate about this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to just do one paper a year. I want to do one every month if I could possibly pull that off, which is hard to do. So what we did is we said, look, is there a way that people can be at the comfort of their own living room, which, by the way, puts them at ease. It actually helps allow them to be natural. But can we allow them to take this experiment from the comfort of their own living room? We would need permissions for us to record them. So they have to have a webcam and things like that, which pretty much everyone has, right? So we went through all the permissions, which is easy. I can do that through my university. It's very standard. But then once that information is collected, it's recorded on your computer, on their computer, and then it is stacked at Affectiva. So 600 people in one treatment, another 600, all of those things, because the video starts and stops at the same point, we know exactly what people's reactions were the entire time. And so these can be stacked or concatenated, whatever you want to describe it as. And now I have a data set of 1,200 people that I collected in I think about 2 or 3 days, which is an absolute data collection miracle in the experimental world. You cannot do this with other fields. And so for that alone, that'd be a reason why somebody would want to use the software.
Yeah.
Once it was stacked, Affectiva said, look, I'm going to send it back to you in an Excel spreadsheet, which obviously any faculty member would love. And that uploads into any kind of statistical software. Like every software is going to be friendly to that.
Yeah.
And, we were off and running. We did the analysis in-house and, share the results from there. It was great.
Awesome. That's so great. Was there anything that surprised you during this process or in the findings?
Well, the findings themselves, what we found, I should start with that.
Sure.
Is that people who strategically default, it's not like they don't have good FICO scores and they don't, these folks, if anything, were more financially knowledgeable, not less. You know, that's a story you hear too often on the TV. But it was people who were more knowledgeable and had actually higher income. But he needed both of those. You couldn't have just one or the other. You needed both the income and the financial knowledge, because then you could, for example, if you want to hire a personal real estate attorney to run the numbers and say, what if we were to walk away from the mortgage? Can we get away with that? What are the ramifications, both social and legal? Are they going to come back and grab the house? And what we know from other papers I've done is that for the most part, they're not going to sue you. They really want to settle. The lender in this case, let's say it's a bank, they don't want to own your house. Real estate, they don't want that. They're in the business of loaning money, in the business of collecting that money.
Right.
And so that's what they want. And so people are very afraid of what's going to happen. But at least after 2008, those things did not happen. And so the fear was there, but that did not match with reality whatsoever. And so again, in the paper, just a quick summary of the finding is that if you had high income and if you had much financial literacy knowledge, right, so you really knew what you were doing, you're actually more likely to strategically default. And those types of variables are not collected in your traditional risk models, right? If anything, it would go the other way. Your FICO is high. Why? Because you've never defaulted before. Yeah, but if your FICO is high, there's probably reasons why it got high. You pay your bills on time. You have a good income. Your debt to total, income is low. And so it was almost a counter finding, but that's why. And again, these are perceptions of it. So if you defaulted on your mortgage before, you probably don't perceive it to be so, amoral. But if you've never done it, it's easy to be judgmental about it, right?
Okay.
It was a great finding, and I'm so happy that it won a Best Paper of the Year award.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I remember in our prior conversations, we talked a lot about, kind of larger financial institutions and their reliance on a more conservative, risk-averse kind of predictive models versus looking at what AI can do. And it's definitely exploded recently. So I'm curious, with your knowledge and your expertise, what would you say some of the biggest challenges are with regards to AI applications, perhaps when it comes to its use in the world of finance, and mm-hmm. how companies can best overcome that?
Sure. A lot of things I could say about this. So let me just start by saying that artificial intelligence, absolutely, it's going to happen. It's not, what if it, no. It's here, and it's only going to get smarter and more evolved and more capable and so forth. So I think right now the difficulty is that if you are a policymaker, you're setting housing policies, for example, you can't just say, hey, the AI told me this would work, and so it's a black box. You can't see in the black box. We don't know how the variables interact. We don't even really know what it's using as variables. But hey, it seems to work. Let's trust it. That's not, watch iRobot, and you might understand why people don't want to just allow AI to set our rules. We should still be in charge of the technology. Yeah. I also want to tell people, don't have an opinion of technology yet. I mean, a hammer, okay? So a hammer, I can make you a beautiful desk, but I can also turn it around and ruin that beautiful desk with the same tool. So it's right. Not the technology that itself is inherently good or evil. It's how are you going to use it? Now, as a person who studies human behavior, I'm still going to warn you, hey, there's a lot of bad actors out there. So still, please be careful and monitor and have all of these, monitoring mechanisms in place. But I can tell you, although I know that these tools and so forth, they can be incredibly insightful and effective, they can also be detrimental. And so it's always going to be the case that the technology is ahead of the law. I mean, that's just the way it is in all throughout history, and it's just always going to be that way. So be a forethought leader here. Think about what might happen. Think about how people could misstep, even the best intended folks could make a misstep. But is there anything we can do to kind of rein it in and to kind of arrive at a more gradual pace? The difficulty there is everyone wants to be first. And if you're first, you're not always careful, right? If the lights are off and I said, hey, run to the mailbox as fast as you can, you're probably gonna kick something or trip on it, right? But if I say, hey, can you carefully go there and not break anything, you're not gonna break anything. But then you're not going to be first. And no one's going to know your name in history because you aren't the one who discovered it. So there's a natural human nature component that is, that will violate all the good advice I just gave us. Yes. But you know, we're humans. The big joke is humans. They're the worst, right?
Yeah, so, we are. We really are.
We're almost in it. But yeah, that's the challenge that these policymakers have. That technology can be amazing, but oh my goodness, we're going to have to keep an eye on it. And there's no great way to do that, by the way. So I'm optimistic, but I'm also a bit realistic in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we covered a lot of ground today, but if you had one takeaway for the audience listening, what would you like to tell them?
I would say be open-minded about these new ideas. Think about how something can help you. I would also throw out there that being creative and building something, truly creating something, whether that's a company or a product or developing an idea, whatever your world is, that is hard. It takes time. It is just wrought with pitfalls all around you. Destroying something is easy. Give me a 1 minute, I can destroy almost anything. Give me a year, I might never be able to build it. So, you know, think in terms of what can we do? I mean, let's work together. All positive things out there, be creative and be passionate about what you're doing. And please think of the good. I know profits matter and that's great, pursue profits. But, you know, if you have to pull back on profits a little to get a great social benefit, can we please do that? You know, I'm happy with the 23% return. I'd be happy with a 20% return if you did the right thing. So it's not the only thing that matters. Yes, I know investors care, but there are more things to life. And so let's all think about that.
So love it. Great message to end on. So for our listeners, can you let us know where they can go to learn more? Or do you have any other call to action for them? Maybe what's next for you? Do you have anything you want to tease or upcoming research that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll throw some things out there. So in terms of a call to action, you can go to my website. If you just Google my name, Michael Seiler, and then William & Mary, you'll very quickly find my homepage. I've got my CV on there, like an academic resume. It's got all the papers I'm working on. It even has the ones that I've published in the past. So you can, you know, and my phone number's there. People say, don't put your phone number on there. My cell phone's on there. It's fine. I'm a regular person just like you, right? So you can call me and talk to me about ideas. That's great. In terms of teasing, in this one particular area, we have developed an application. And instead of, well, let me back up. So people are now thinking, hey, let's have homeownership be accessible to everybody, right? And the problem is, let's say that you're an immigrant from another country and you might even have a great track record over there. And you come over here and they say, well, you have basically no track record. We can't get a FICO score. You have no financial history at all. We'll start you off with you paying us to have the luxury of a $500 limit credit card. You're like, ah, I feel like I'm a teenager, right? Like, I've already gone through this in my own country.
Oh, man.
So whether you're new to this country and you find it hard to obtain credit, or whether you're just simply a young person and you find it hard to obtain credit, because again, you're young, you don't have that history. We have now a model that shows a better predictive ability of loan performance than using all of the FICO scores and DTI and all the things that you have to put on your mortgage application. We are now using a various combinations of personality traits, and it's shown to be more effective. And so this is a rare case where we can not exclude people from the credit markets, which is a huge objection that people have.
So we can
include more people in the market, which is what we want. And we can do so with better predictability. It's rare that you get a win-win. Normally you win something, you have to give something up. Here we believe we have a win-win. We just completed the paper in a ready-to-share format, and we're putting it on a thing called SSRN, and we will be presenting that paper for as many places who will hear us talk. So that's one thing I'd like to tease. And the other one, I'll keep it real short. I have a project, and this is internal. I'm calling it Tinder for Housing, so you might know what Tinder is, the dating app. Tinder for Housing goes back to this stated versus revealed preference. So if I'm an agent and you are looking for a home, then actually you come to me and you say, well, Mike, I want a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, this neighborhood, this kind of, you know. And I say, okay, great, I hear you. And then I go look at my database. I take you out and I say, here are the 4 homes that best match what you told me. And you don't like any of those homes. So you think Mike doesn't listen to me. And I think Ashley can't explain what she wants. Okay, the truth is there's something else going on there. So you have just stated your preference to me. And it's not just that you're stating it, but I'm also receiving that signal. And maybe I do it with noise, meaning that I don't hear you clearly. And so the idea is to have this app. This app would be, don't tell me anything. Go on to my app. I have curb appeal photos. That's the front picture of the home.
Yep. Yep.
And so maybe you have a different preference. You like Georgian, or someone else likes Victorian. Okay, great. I'll show you one of each. And you just flip to the right if you like that one, and flip to the left if you like the other one. And after you make a couple of these choices, I'm going to stop you and say, you know, the app is going to stop you and say, you know what? I got it. I know what you like in terms of house and style. Okay, let's go inside. We've got kitchen, master bedroom, master bathroom, main living area, maybe a view. I'm going to show you these six parts of the home. And it's the same thing. You're just going to swipe back and forth depending on what you like. Pretty soon, I'm going to now know what you want. So how does it work now? You call me and say, hey, I'm interested in buying a house. I say, great, download my app, do this little test. And then when you're done, I will take you to places I'm quite sure that you will like. Very we cut cool. out all the conversation. It's faster. It's yeah. more convenient. You can do it whenever you want, right? You can do it while you're waiting for your laundry to dry, right, at home. And so it's just very convenient. And if it works, which our early indications are that it does work, then, hey, that could really be something that adds efficiency to the market, which we're all about. So those are just two of the dozen projects I have going on. I love them all.
Just
a couple. I'm a child. I love all the children, but those are two that pop in my head.
Okay, perfect. I love it. Okay, well, that's all I had for you, Mike. It was such a pleasure speaking with you. And once again, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much.
I thought this was a fascinating discussion on the cutting edge of consumer research and the future of financial products. I also liked Mike's point about how AI can be a tool and it is so much more potential to be used for good while keeping the human in the loop. So I hope that you enjoy today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Human-Centric AI podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts for new episodes. We're also on social media, so please reach out to us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram to share any feedback you have on the show and weigh in on the discussion using hashtag Human-Centric AI podcast. Don't forget to rate us and comment with your feedback to help make the podcast more discoverable for others. Until next time, thanks for listening.